What I want to speak on today is a recasting and a reinterpretation of quantum mechanics based primarily on two ideas, which I'll define for you, the idea of preclusion and the idea of anhomomorphic inference. But first, maybe I should say a little bit about why we would want to do such a thing. Why would we seek another interpretation of quantum mechanics? What would we hope for it to do? Now, unfortunately, the focus is not very good, so I'll try to move things along so that the relevant section of the transparency is in focus. Let me know if you can't see it. So, can people read what's on the top of the transparency now? In the back, too? Okay. Yeah, so why would we seek another interpretation of quantum mechanics? What would we hope for from it? One thing is that we hope it might help point the way to quantum gravity. Just to take one example, it might tell us whether a three-dimensional or four-dimensional kind of formulation is more likely to be promising. If you know me at all, you know how I'll answer that question, and that'll become manifest also in the course of the talk. It might also help us not to construct quantum gravity, but it might help us, once we have the formalism, if and when we do, to understand what it means, since if we can't understand the non-relativistic formalism, we'll certainly have a hard time to understand the quantum formalism. Or it might be that we just want to understand quantum mechanics better. Indeed, I suppose that for most people who work on foundations of quantum mechanics, that's the primary motivation. And then finally, it might, and this is perhaps more of a long shot, something less likely to actually be realized, but who knows, it might lead to new types of dynamics beyond the sort that we usually associate with quantum mechanics. Something like that potentially can happen from what I'm going to describe in terms of a new concept called co-event, which I'll describe for you. I think, as another example, I think the kind of thing that Lucian was talking about can be thought of in this way. It's a new, by thinking of the most basic facts about quantum mechanics, if we understand them in a new way, it might lead to a new form of dynamical law. So what's wrong with the interpretations we already have? Well, there are many, and I certainly won't discuss them all. But let's think about the Copenhagen interpretation, which is kind of a minimal interpretation. Many people are unhappy with it for one reason or another, and they'd probably express their discomfort in different ways. But maybe the thing that underlies it is pretty similar for most people, and I would express it this way, that kind of interpretation doesn't provide us with what I would call an image of reality, an image of reality that covers not only instruments and macroscopic things, but microscopic things. After all, quantum mechanics was developed on microscopic world, and that's where it really has its home. But if you don't provide that, and you consider that macroscopic things, instruments and other macroscopic things, are really composed of microscopic things, then what you're really saying is that it doesn't provide us with an image or descriptive way of talking about the macroscopic world or the microscopic world. So if we want to say, for example, that there's, well, let's say, 100 people in this room, there's no way of putting that into the descriptive language that the interpretation of the Copenhagen type provides for us. Or if we want to say that there are 8 planets, or is it 9 planets? I can't remember now. But because of that lack or that inability, we can't speak directly about the early universe. And from the point of view of quantum mechanics, or quantum gravity, sorry, that's obviously a problem because some of the anticipated applications of greatest interest of quantum gravity are in quantum cosmology and deal with the early universe. So if we take this point of view that we're interested in not only an interpretation, but one that will mate well with quantum gravity, or maybe lead us to quantum gravity, this tends to lead us in different directions than people have traditionally mostly followed. Let me give a few examples. That if we think not even of general relativity, but just special relativity. We have quantum field theory, and although I don't have time to describe this fully here, I claim it's already true that the usual measurement paradigm of what's called the Dirac von Neumann sort already breaks down for quantum field theory. It's just not possible to assume that every self-adjoint operator defined on a Cauchy surface or near a Cauchy surface can be measured near that Cauchy surface if you, in an ideal sense, by an ideal measurement. If you make that assumption, you can prove that you can transmit information faster than light. If we assume that that's impossible, then what we learn is that there really is no standard measurement theory for relativistic quantum mechanics. Another thing, so you in some sense need to seek a new interpretation. Another thing that becomes very suspect when you think in relativistic terms is the notion of subsystem. Many of the interpretive attempts for quantum mechanics are based on that idea. You see it a lot in connections with many worlds, for example. And yet it's very suspect if you think in space-time terms. If you're thinking of a collection of particles like non-relativistic quantum mechanics, then a subsystem can be a certain set of particles, even though that doesn't probably work perfectly either. But if you're thinking in terms of quantum field theory, what could it be? Still less, what could it be if you're thinking in terms of a dynamical metric? So what all this suggests, and what the relativistic viewpoint itself suggests, is to base an interpretation not on these ideas, but on the idea of history, or something like a history. I'll use the word generalized trajectory, because the first example of a history in non-relativistic quantum mechanics is a particle trajectory. And the word history has come to have too many different meanings. So if we try to construct a theory along these lines, what we might end up with, and what I will try to show that we do end up with, is a notion of reality which is a generalized trajectory, what you might call a quantum trajectory, because it's not classical in its logical properties. It exhibits contradictory attributes, and these attributes, in fact, the full description of reality, all the properties of the generalized trajectory that represents reality, will be described by what I'll call a co-event. So that's where we're heading. Obviously, most of those terms will be a little vague to you to start with, so I hope not so vague at the end of the talk. So let me try to go now to making some of them more precise. So most theories, I think all the theories that we're familiar with, have this general structure of kinematics and dynamics. And the kinematics is based on what I will call an event algebra. The terminology I'm adopting here is that of a probability theory, specifically the theory of stochastic processes, which arguably is the best kind of classical analog of a quantum theory, or the best intermediate between classical dynamics and quantum dynamics. So in that situation, you have this capital omega, which is called the sample space. It consists of trajectories. So if we're doing non-relativistic quantum mechanics, an element of omega is a set of particle trajectories or world lines. If we were doing, say, general relativity, classical relativity, an element of omega is a four geometry, and so on. If we were doing classical physics, then reality would be identified with one of these trajectories. However, I'm calling them formal because we'll see that it will not be identified in the end with such a trajectory, but they'll be related more indirectly to what we will be identifying as reality. Now, given this set of trajectories, we can form subsets of it, and these subsets go by the name of events in probability theory. So we get from it a set of subsets, which is a larger space, and this space actually will be the central one in the discussion. But it's not only a set, it's an algebra, and I'll say why in a second. But let me mention some names of these so to help you think about it. One word is event. Another word that's used is, if you can read this, well, this is subset, as I just said, a subset of the sample space. Sometimes they're called predicates. They're also called questions, and there are other names for them. So in any case, given an element of this event algebra, an element A, it's a subset of the sample space. And why is it called an event? Well, suppose we were dealing, our theory was a theory of weather, and our sample space consisted of weather patterns. We have the question, is it raining? Or if you like, the predicate of rainingness, or the proposition that it is raining. They're just different names for the same concept. But what it corresponds to is a subset. It corresponds to the set of all the patterns in which it is raining. And then the statement that it's not raining corresponds to the set of all the patterns, weather patterns in which there's not rain. Now this forms an algebra. It has a multiplication, it has an addition, and so on. It's called the Boolean algebra. Multiplication is easy to understand and pretty familiar to many people. Given two events or two subsets of the sample space, their intersection is the logical product, or the product in this algebraic sense, and it corresponds to the logical connective of AND. The sum, the one that makes it a true algebra, is less familiar. It's not the OR, as you might think, but it's the exclusive OR. It corresponds to the exclusive OR, and what it is what's sometimes called symmetric difference. So an element belongs to A plus B if and only if it belongs to one of A and B without belonging to the other one of A and B. There are also scalars in the algebra, the field being Z2, and 1 and 0 are the two scalars. 1 will be identified with true and 0 with false. There's a 0 in the algebra, which is the empty set. There's a 1, which if you trace through the definitions, is the space as a whole. And there's, if you want to see how negation looks, it's just addition of 1. With these rules, you can convince yourself that all the postulates for an algebra are satisfied. For example, multiplication distributes over addition, and so on. So this will be the basic kinematical structure that I'll be dealing with. But where should we start in trying to build an interpretation based on it? Well, what is it that makes it hard to come up with an interpretation of quantum mechanics? The problem are these paradoxes, of which the prototype is possibly the Bell inequalities. That's a paradox involving probability theory. There are other versions of these, which are paradoxes involving just plain logic. Yes, no, without probability is coming in. Probably the original one of these is the Kochan-Specker thought experiment, or paradox. One of the simplest to think about is the one that Lucien suggested, and that was actually very useful in building up the interpretation I'll talk about, and it's now been essentially completely analyzed by Cole Fury, although I won't really have time to talk about what the result of that analysis says in this talk. What I will talk about in detail is a somewhat even simpler example that doesn't, it's so simple that it doesn't have the tie-in with non-locality and causality that some of these others have. But it does, to my mind, illustrate the essential problem in coming up with a realistic interpretation of quantum mechanics. And that's the three-slit, what I'm calling the three-slit experiment. So let me briefly run over that. It's too high now. Yeah. Okay. So, three-slit experiment is diffraction with a single particle and three alternative paths sets of paths that it can follow. One set that I'll call A, of which I've shown a typical path here, one B, one C, and then there are others that I won't bother with now where it just goes off in some random place on the screen. The ones that I'll be interested in will be all those that land at a particular selected location on the screen, which I've called here P. And it's easy enough to choose the amplitude so that with respect to that location, the class A and the class B destructively interfere with each other. So the net amplitude for a particle to arrive at P via either of these two paths is zero. So for example, if you actually were to close off C, you would never see any particles landing here. We can also arrange that B plus C is zero. Here this plus is the plus I defined for you, which in this case is just simple union, because A, B, and C are disjoint sets. So B and C are also destructively interfere, and yet A, B, and C taken together don't, of course, because A plus B is zero, the amplitudes, and then C is left over. This notation I'm using here is for what I'm calling the quantum measure. This is now getting at the sort of reformulation of quantum mechanics in the history's language. And in fact, it's the square, in this case, it's the square of the amplitude. I'll define it more generally in a little bit. But I think you can see already the basic idea from this example. So now I'm going to, here's the important step that we're going to take. I'm going to assume that this path, this set A plus B, doesn't happen even if we don't put a detector here, and whether or not we block off C, that it's a property of that pair itself to be what I'll call precluded, borrowing a word from Bob Geroge. So it's a property of reality that the question, does the particle go through set through one of the two slits A or B and land at P, the answer to that must be no for any allowable reality. Similarly, the answer must be no for B plus C for any dynamically allowed reality. So A plus B and B plus C are what I've called precluded, but A plus B plus C, of course, is not. You often will get particles. If you put a detector here, you'll often get it registering particles. This, from the point of view of classical logic, would be a contradiction, and that's why we're going to be led to changing the rules of classical logic. To see how to change them, it's useful to be very careful. I mean, it's an obvious contradiction, because we're so trained in thinking classically, but it's useful to go through carefully in the algebraic sense and see how the contradiction would be derived and where we can change something to remove the contradiction. So let me do that now. So the contradiction is derived by using what I'll call rules of inference, rules of passing from one statement about reality to another. Those rules of inference concern what this function phi, which some people might call a truth function, I'll call it a co-event because it's a map from the space of events to the scalars. Not necessarily a linear map, but just a map. So it takes you, for every question you can ask, remember the elements of this event algebra can be thought of as questions about reality. For every question you can ask, it gives you the answer. If you knew all the answers, that is, if you knew phi fully, you'd have a full description of reality. Now the statement that that we obey classical rules of inference is the statement that phi is a homomorphism. It preserves and, or not. This allows you to derive propositions from other propositions. Was there a question? Okay. So in this case, A plus B was precluded. That means that the answer to A plus B, its truth value, is zero. Similarly, B plus C was precluded. Therefore, since it preserves multiplication, phi of A plus B times B plus C must also be zero. But what is A plus B and B plus C? Well, that's this set intersect this set. Multiplication is intersection, so it's B. So we learn that phi of B is zero. This we've used so far preservation of and. If phi of B is zero, then phi of A plus B must be just phi of A using linearity, preservation of plus. So phi of A is zero. And then finally, applying that to phi of A plus B plus C, breaking it up as A plus B plus C, we get it as the sum of two things which we know to be zero, and therefore it's zero. So the prediction would be that the particle never, if we ask the question, does it go through one of A plus B or C and end up at P, the answer would be no, which is a false prediction. This is what we have to avoid. In order to avoid it, we can consider weakening the preclusion rule so that we don't always demand that every precluded set be false, be assigned to zero, or, and this is the inclusive or, we could do both, of course, we can weaken the rules of inference. And what I'm going to talk about in this talk is based on the latter approach, weakening the rules of inference. Before doing that, I want to put this in a slightly more general context instead of just the three-slit experiment. It gives a little more precision to some of the objects that I had defined before, like the quantum measure from which preclusion follows. So I think I'll rush a little bit here because some of you may have seen something like this and be familiar with it. If not, it's not crucial to get all the details. So what the quantum measure does is it assigns to any set of histories, any element of the event algebra, it assigns a non-negative real number, and that's given by a path integral in which you integrate over pairs of paths, what I call sometimes a Schwinger history and what Balogh tends to call closed time paths, I think. You integrate over pairs of paths this expression, the amplitude of the one times the conjugate amplitude of the other with a delta function that sort of glues them together at a final truncation time, which is to some extent arbitrary, but it doesn't matter because of unitarity. Anyway, I'm going too fast, but just to say everything once. This is closely related to what's called the decoherence functional. There's also a typo here. This zero should say, if you're actually reading that carefully, this zero should say measure of A, not zero. But I won't be using this property as such. It's very useful in some of the theorems that I may refer to, but I won't be needing it for the specific theorem that I'm going to quote. So the important thing here is that this is the generalization of that probability of arriving at the screen by a certain class of paths. And it's defined in general for any set of histories, and it has various nice properties. I call it the quantum measure. Now, in some situations, this can be identified with something on whose interpretation everyone agrees. The textbook rules for quantum mechanics tell us that if this A is not an arbitrary set of histories, but it's a set of histories that describes an event, well, it always describes an event by definition of event. If that event is what I'm calling an instrument event, in other words, it's a statement about something that a pointer is doing or something like a pointer is doing, then you can prove that when this quantum measure is zero, the standard rules predict that the instrument will not do that. That event will not happen. It predicts that because what it predicts more generally is that in that situation, this quantum measure can be identified as the probability of that instrument outcome. So this is just the standard rules. What I'm going to do here to free this from the reference to instruments and macroscopic objects is to extend it to all events. We're going to assume that any event whose measure is zero is precluded. It doesn't happen, which we'll interpret to mean that this co-event assigns it zero or false. So that's the basic fundamental idea of preclusion. It's just a generalization of what we saw in a more informal way in the case of the three slit experiments. However, we also saw that to do justice to the truth, true predictions, and to accommodate this idea, we need to change the rules of inference. In fact, if you don't change the rules of inference, you can get just out-and-out logical contradictions using examples like the Kochen-Specker one. So how do we change the rules of inference? We have to weaken them in some way. And there's more than one path for doing that suggests itself. And in fact, we've played around with, I don't even like to think how many different versions of how to do this. What we're doing is constructing a new theory of inference to replace the one that we're abandoning, or partly abandoning. The one that so far seems to have the combination of simplicity with viability is the one that I'm going to talk about now, although I should stress there are others. I'll call it the multiplicative scheme. Because in this scheme, we remember that a classical co-event preserves both addition and multiplication. It's a homomorphism. In this multiplicative scheme, we preserve multiplication, which corresponded to logical and, but we don't preserve the sum, which corresponded, remember, to XOR. Now I'm going to sort of rush through some mathematics. It's not really very deep, although it uses a lot of fancy words like filter. If you demand that the co-event, phi, preserve multiplication, which is the and, then phi inverse of 1 can be shown to be a filter. Phi inverse of 1 is the set of all events which happen, or which are assigned true. So the set of all events that happen, which is a set of subsets of the sample space, is a filter. I won't even bother to define it. I remind you that phi was this map from the co-events, from the events to the scalars, true, false. But what is important, what you can prove without using this fancy language, is that in this situation, there will be the whole co-event phi, that is the whole reality, will be described by a single subset of the sample space, which I've called here F. Once you have that subset, you know whether every other subset is either true or false. The rule is this, that if let phi be this distinguished set, let A be any other set, if it contains F, then it's true. If it doesn't contain F, like this green subset B, it might meet F, but if it doesn't contain F, then it's false. This is a consequence of assuming that we preserve the multiplication or the AND. Here's a little proof of part of that fact, which I'll skip over. Now, if we were to go further and say that phi, that the set of true events, the set of events which actually happen, is not only a filter but a maximal filter, we would find that plus is also preserved, and we'd be back to classical logic. But we'd find that we also were assigning true to some precluded event, which we can't do. So the natural move here is to weaken the maximality to maximal preclusive. In other words, that phi should be a maximal filter subject to the condition that it assign false to all the precluded events. In terms of this F, from which everything follows, what it works out to mean is that F is as small as it can be without falling within any precluded event. So that's the basic scheme here. For those, the possible co-events, the possible realities are identified with subsets of the sample space, which are preclusive in the sense that they don't fall inside any precluded event, so they won't assign it true. And they're as small as possible otherwise. This leads to a different inference scheme, which I call an homomorphic inference, an meaning not a homomorphic. So it doesn't preserve both multiplication and addition, so it's not homomorphic. So you could call the logical scheme that belongs to an homomorphic logic, which was the title I used in my talk. It's also a dynamics, because if you think about it, dynamics is really inference. So what is all this? It might probably sound, I'm sure it does sound a little bit abstract and confusing. Let's work it out in that three-slitter case where we can do everything quite explicitly. So remember, in that situation, there were three alternatives that we were interested in, A, which was the first slit, B, the second slit, and C, the third. And I'm going to actually collapse those to points, so I imagine that there's only one trajectory for each, so these things will just be three points, really. Then A plus B was precluded, remember, A, that's this set, B plus C was also precluded. So classically, you would have said, well, the true trajectory can't be in here, it can't be in here, so it can't be in any of these. That was the contradiction. But we have to be careful and use the new rules of inference. So A plus B and B plus C are still precluded. Given this multiplicative scheme, what it means is that our set F that defines the reality, or co-event, it can't be contained totally within A union B or within B union C. So if it can't be A plus B, it has to have C. If it can't be A plus C, it has to have A. So it has to have it both A and C. So the smallest one we can have is F is equal to A plus C. Another one that's preclusive is A plus B plus C, but it's not minimal, but so by the rules that we've adopted, it's not a potential reality. It's not a valid, dynamically valid co-event. So in this case, there's only one dynamically allowed co-event, which is A plus C. Obviously, in more complicated cases, there'll be many, but in this case, there's only one, and we can say, see explicitly how it's strange from the point of view of classical logic. It assigns false. Remember, what a co-event does is it answers every question you might ask. That is, it assigns true or false to every subset of the sample space. So this assigns false to the empty set, to the sets A, B, C, A plus B, and B plus C. It assigns true, if you just trace through the rules that I gave you, it assigns true to A plus C and A plus B plus C, which is the whole sample space, or the whole part of it, of interest. So in particular, it assigns true to the question, does the particle pass through one of the three slits and end at the point B, point P, sorry. So in this co-event, the particle does go to that location. In terms of question and answer, you have the following strange situation. Did it go through A? No. Did it go through B? No. Did it go through C? No. Did it go through A or B or C? Yes. So that's the contradictory nature of this logic. But it makes it possible for things that should happen quantum mechanically to happen. So the idea, in a sense, is that quantum reality incorporates certain kinds of features that, from a classical point of view, would have been called paradoxical or contradictory. But it's all within a well-defined scheme. However, I mean, so this is nice, at least depending on your point of view and how much you thought about it, you might be really charmed by it, as some of us were when we first saw this. But if you're a more cynical type, you might say, well, that's all well and good, but aren't you just playing with words? How are you going to get out of this any kind of real restrictions on the reality that'll give the kind of predictions that we use quantum mechanics to make? It just looks here like anything can happen. You don't have to obey the rules of logic. But we did have rules. I gave you a very definite scheme. And in this, I claim that this task of showing that there's real content to this model, in fact, the task of solving what you might call the measurement problem, reduces essentially to the following thing. Can we recover a classical reality for the right set of variables, the macroscopic variables or the instrument variables? Now, we know, at least to first approximation, that if we think about macroscopic things and things related to measurement and so on, that ordinary logic does work. Now, I wouldn't want to push that too far. I mean, in my own experience, I can think of plenty of cases where ordinary logic didn't seem to describe my experience very well, even of macroscopic things. But we can put that down either to some subtle quantum effects that we haven't been aware of, but we can also put it down just to memory lapses or who knows what. But anyway, to a very good approximation, we should be able to recover classical reality, which means that when restricted to an appropriate subalgebra, appropriate set of questions, those dealing with macroscopic things, that we should get yes-no answers that are consistent with classical logic. That is, phi, restricted to that subalgebra, should be a homomorphism. So just to review what I just said, phi in general describes a quantal reality, and as such, it's an homomorphic function. But we would like it restricted to some suitable macroscopic subalgebra to be classical, which means homomorphic. And then you wouldn't get these funny kind of answers that A can be false, B can be false, but A or B can be true. Once you've done that, then you would, I mean, there's a little more to be said, but basically you would have reproduced the predictions of quantum mechanics. So what I'm going to give you here is a theorem that goes some way in the direction, just to show that this is not an idle hope. It's a theorem that goes some way in the direction of reproducing quantum mechanics like that. Not all the way, but a significant part of the way. And this is the theorem. It's not too hard to prove for the case of the scheme I'm describing for you, the multiplicative scheme, although it's still not totally proved in some of the other schemes that we've been toying with. But it can be proved not too many steps for this scheme that I'm describing to you now, which preserves and so on. So let S be any subalgebra of the event algebra A. That's a set of questions you might ask rather than all the questions. And let it be subalgebra closed under the logical operations. And let it be such that let it have the following property, that for any event at all which is precluded, its intersection with anything in the subalgebra is also precluded. So if the subalgebra has that special property, then you can prove that the restriction of this coevent to that subalgebra is a homomorphism. It's classical. So if we could prove that there was a well-defined macroscopic subalgebra and it had this property, then we'd be home free. We can't fully do that, and it might be actually that the assumption is a little bit too strong in the form I stated it, but there's a couple of special cases that are quite significant. The first one is classical deterministic theories. So what do I mean by a deterministic theory? We have the same event algebra, say again, an element of the sample space is, for example, a set of trajectories or a four geometry, again, that thing that would have been the reality classically. Within the set of all conceivable formal trajectories, there's a subset which satisfies the equations of motion. I'll call that E. What classical physics deterministically tells us is that the true one can belong, the true trajectory can belong to E and not to omega outside of E. What that says, if we translate it into this language, is that an event A is precluded if and only if it fails to contain any element of E. If we make that our definition of a precluded event, it turns out that this it satisfies this condition. It's easy to see that. And so the theorem applies. That means that we can identify S with the whole event algebra and we recover classical logic. So if our set of preclusions is that coming from a classical deterministic field theory, then classical logic applies and we can conclude that reality is described just by a single trajectory. That set F is now as small, which is always as small as possible, it now shrinks down to just one element, and that one element can be identified with reality. The other special case is classical again, but classical stochastic dynamics. In this case, the quantum measure is a probability measure. If you're familiar with Brownian motion, you'll be familiar with this formulation, the Wiener process. A set is now precluded if and only if its measure is zero. The same theorem applies again, and we again conclude that the logic of this theory is classical. So we've successfully recovered classical logic and the classical notion of reality in dealing with classical physics. It's two versions, the deterministic and the stochastic ones. Reality is then described by a single element of omega. So this theorem is taking us in the direction of what we want, and it might even be that we come very close to it if we consider not just macroscopic variables, or microscopic events, but events that result in the formation of records. You can actually argue that maybe this theorem does apply there. So it's quite promising that we'll be able to recover the standard quantum predictions. So that's the scheme as I wanted to describe it to you. Just a couple of concluding comments about how to think about this scheme. There are two different ways we might talk about it, which I think are just, I think they are just that. They're different ways of talking about the same thing. They're not fundamentally different interpretations, but they're slightly different viewpoints on the same interpretation. Some might appeal more to some people, and one might appeal more to other people. The first one, which I've referred to a few times, let's go back. I said the purpose of a quantum interpretation was to answer the question, what is a quantum reality? In the first way of looking at the scheme I've just described for you, a quantum reality, or reality, I should say, because we are in a quantum world, presumably, reality is a trajectory, but what you could call a quantal trajectory. I call it quantal, and of course this means generalized trajectory. So it's a quantal generalized trajectory. It's quantal because its properties are described by this coevent phi, the answers to all the questions you might have asked about the reality. This set of answers doesn't obey classical rules of inference. In fact, each question you can ask corresponds to a property, as we said before. And these properties, reality can be such that some of the properties contradict each other. So in this way of looking at it, there are genuine contradictions in nature. This has a very old history. The oldest suggestion of this sort that I know of is from the Jain philosophy, 2,500 years ago or whatnot. Another source that people often point to is Heraclitus. And in much more recent times, there are Hegel, Marx, and many other people suggesting some genuine contradictory, what's often called dialectical view of reality. The other way of viewing it, instead of saying that phi describes a reality with contradictory properties, you can just say, well, if we have the full description of reality, that is the reality. So phi itself can be thought of as the quantum reality. So it's a replacement of the generalized trajectory as a reality with this full set of properties that would have been properties of the classical trajectory. In that case, we can reason about phi using classical logic. And of course, in the whole discussion I just gave, that's what I did. So I think that they should be thought of as different, slightly different viewpoints on essentially the same interpretation. The important thing is that no matter which viewpoint you take, the rules of inference have to be changed, and they're now what I called anhomomorphic. Not only are they anhomomorphic, meaning that they don't preserve the or and the and the not, that is, they don't preserve the plus and the times in that algebraic formulation. But this is also important. They're not universal. The rules of inference for classical logic were universal. If you had a compound proposition made out of individual propositions and you knew the truth or falsehood of the individual ones, you always knew the truth or falsehood of the compound. Here it depends very much on which the proposition it is, because the set of precluded events, which refers to the whole quantum measure somehow, is being used to define F and define the ultimately phi. So these rules of inference are no longer universal, but they depend on the dynamics that you adopted. If you like, they depend on the physical system that you're looking at. So that's somehow maybe the main message of this talk. And then bringing back that little hint that I raised in the introduction, who knows? Here we defined the co-event, we found the possible sets of co-events by starting from preclusion. Preclusion came from the path integral or something, a slight generalization of the path integral and using the Schwinger histories to produce what I call the quantum measure. But ultimately, we just have rules of inference relating facts about the co-event. So perhaps someday we'll bypass the path integrals and formulate dynamics directly in terms of these rules of inference, that is, directly as conditions on the co-event. That would indeed be a very new formulation and might lead to a very different idea of quantum gravity.
And so, in summing that both versions of these talks have in common, which is that you accept as done deal the topless nature of quantum theories, and you try to make quantum based on more properties. And I just want to mention the other option. The other option is that the statistical nature of quantum mechanics is a feature of the physics of the subsystem of the universe. And the system of the whole universe would have to be instead of not both dynamics becomes probabilistic when we restrict attention to sources.
Let me think. I'm certainly not trying to make it more probabilistic. I'm just trying to come up with an interpretation that does justice to the world as we think quantum mechanics makes it. If the world were actually deterministic, as you say, well, that was a special case of this, but you wouldn't need to have done all this work to get back to that special case. My own belief is that it's hopeless to think that the universe, that reality is deterministic, because if you think of the very early universe, assuming that there was a very early universe, sort of the beginning, here I'm thinking of a causal set where there are very few elements of the causal set present, to say that dynamics is deterministic would say that there was already enough information, so to speak, in those few elements to fully determine the whole future. So to me, that there wouldn't be in the early universe what I might call the material basis for that determination of what subsequently follows. So I'm not particularly wedded to probability as such, but I think that my own feeling is that determinism is not really a viable option. Which doesn't mean I have a lot of, don't have a lot of sympathy for some of the things you said, but when you say deterministic, then we part company.
I guess I can formulate at least the common thing with general logic. Generally, one feels that logic is about the structure of language, and language is about the world. So the logic only deals with the world secondhand. But there is also a tradition in philosophy called panlogism. Logic deals basically with the structure of the world. Logic would be the outstanding example of that one. And I feel that's one of the dangers of this approach. And it makes us, at least so quiet, we accept what the theory tells us about, that that's the nature of the structure of the world. We can't do anything about it. Whereas, if you see, this is just another way of reformulating the puzzles in another language, and the puzzles remain, whatever was the language.
Well, first of all, I'm not sure I would accept such a sharp distinction between properties of language and properties of the world, since the language is supposed to be designed, if it's a physics language, it's supposed to be designed to describe the world. But certainly, if you forced me to make that distinction, I would say it's this panlogism. We're talking about here exactly about properties of the world. And that became very clear in the fact that's up there, which is there aren't any universal deductive rules or rules of inference just at the level of language itself. You have to know the dynamics in order to come up with those rules of inference. So as far as saying that this is just reformulating the puzzle, that I would reject. I mean, this is meant to be an answer to the puzzle. You may or may not believe that, but I've tried to argue that it is an answer to the puzzle. It lets us do the same kind of things that we could do, but now with a description, with having a genuine image of reality underpinning it. It's getting away from operationalism, and it's really talking about reality. Reality is either a co-event, or it's a generalized trajectory with contradictory properties, but anyway, it's some very well-defined mathematical object.
I'd like to ask you a question about this development of fiber that's on sort of true or false to various things that might be going on in the world. And in addition to true and false, you also have things that might be logically undesignable. And therefore, it might be a non-computable thing.
Well, it certainly might be non-computable, yes.
So what do you think you would, I mean, what would you do with, like, is this sort of an extra something beyond true or false? If you had a situation and you asked, based on whether it was true or false, something would happen. If it was, for example, put a certain program halt on a certain input on some computer, you wouldn't know until it actually run and gone. So the status of truth or falseness would somehow not be there, at least wouldn't be provably there, it wouldn't not be.
Well, okay, so there's a whole tradition in logic of replacing the dichotomy true-false by something more general. When I was reading stuff to try and see where this fits into logic, other things that have been done in non-standard logics, I think that goes by the name of modal logic, but I wouldn't swear that that's the right terminology. So there can be yes, no, maybe. Instead of true and false, you can talk about provable, not provable, or what?
I was actually more thinking more in terms of provable.
Yes, I said, sorry, instead of true or false, you could say provable, not provable. There are all these different attributes or sort of truth values in a generalized sense you can assign. This is just the simplest thing. So if you look at classical logic from a distance, you could say it really has three components. It has the event algebra, the set of things to which you assign true or false. It has the true or false assignment, and it has the map between them, which is what I've called phi. Now, people who do modal logic, say intuitionists, are going to change the set of truth values. That's what you're talking about. People who, what's traditionally called quantum logic, they change the event algebra. It's no longer a Boolean algebra. It becomes a sort of modular lattice or something like that, or an ortho-complemented lattice. What's different about this is it's keeping both of them the same. But what it's focusing on is the map between them, and the rules for that map are getting changed. So that's where this fits in somehow to the bigger picture. I have absolutely nothing against thinking of changing some of the others. I was playing with some of those ideas also, but they didn't, in the end, seem to help to sort out, resolve these paradoxes. What did seem to help is what I've showed you. As far as replacing true by provable, that I'm not so sure about. I mean, that has both its pluses and minuses. But here, truth should be just understood in the traditional sense.
Yes, there's something I don't understand in your example with the pieces. So, it seems to me that when you ask, for example, A and B, you're asking, okay, if I block...
A or B,
A or B, if I block slit C, will I see light going through, and then will I see light at the point of
heat?
And so if that's the question, as I said, it seems to me that the normal quantum case situation where you lose light or something, if you block both B and C, you would see light.
Yes.
But in your particular example, it doesn't.
That's right.
And it seems to me that it's not possible using your structure here to have that. So I'm a bit confused about that.
So you're asking, could I? So that's a very important question. So this assigns true or false to every possible event, but it's not. You might think that what this is doing is that this true or false is to be given some operational interpretation, that we're actually setting up some experiment, like blocking slit C. Then you could ask, for every question that you could ask, is there some experimental setup that you could provide that would answer the question one way or another, that, without answering any other question? I'm not claiming that's true. But I'm saying, so the important point is that this phi of A is not meant to be literally taken as the result of some experiment. It's something that we attribute to A just in itself. So the fact that A plus B was precluded was a fact about A plus B itself. In certain circumstances, it can be sort of exhibited experimentally by blocking C. But blocking B plus C does not directly exhibit the result, the answer to the question, phi of A. Okay, so the difference, so there's a subtlety there which you're getting at, which is a very important subtlety. The difference in this case, at least one of the important differences, is that phi of A plus B was a preclusion in itself. Its measure was zero. The conclusion that phi of A was zero was the statement, was the sort of indirect result of, you know, a set of inferences. But what you say is very right. You cannot naively identify these true and false with any simple experimental tests. It's an interesting question that it might belong to what you call the theory of measurement, whether for some of them you can design tests that will do it, and for some of them you can't, or can you always design a test? I just don't know what the answer is. But the difference between this and ordinary interpretations is that, or some of them, is that the theory of measurement is an interesting thing, but it's not part of the foundations of this theory anymore.
So what you're saying, if I can